Here is the week in Congressman John Faso news. Votes he took, positions he espoused, and protest rallies and town halls that he attended or not. The website 538.com reports that John Faso votes with Donald Trump's positions 88.3% of the time, the same as last week. Congress was out of session this past week and returns June 5th.
Paul Brooks reports in the Times-Herald Record that Representative John Faso was still hopeful about peace in Korea, despite the on-again, off-again, on-again news of discussions between leaders of the U.S. and North Korea. Faso thinks Donald Trump will meet Kim Jong-un. Quote, "I think they will," said Faso, who just returned 3 weeks ago from a five-day visit to South Korea with a congressional delegation. Quote, "I think this is bargaining by the state of North Korea, and the president is right to tell them we are not going to tolerate this kind of attitude," end quote, Faso said in a telephone interview. Quote, "We should anticipate, given the history of the North Korean state, many false starts and U-turns along the way," end quote. You can read the full story in the Times-Herald Record. Friday, June 1st, is the deadline for new voters to register if they want to vote in the June 26th federal primary. Seven Democrats in the 19th Congressional District are vying to challenge Representative John Faso, Republican from Kinderhook. There is also a September 13th state primary election before the November 6th general election. The Mid-Hudson News Network reports that Representative John Faso attacked the Democrats running against him at the GOP nominating convention May 30th in Kingston. Quote, "Most of these guys just moved into the district to run for office," Faso said. "The other thing they're giving us is negativity. They just say no to everything. They oppose everything that we and President Trump try to do. While the other side plays their gender warfare, their identity politics, depending on what group you are part of, that's the wrong way, an un-American point of view. We shouldn't be dividing people by race and gender and class and party and philosophy. We are all Americans. The other side wants to see an America where we are divided into segments based on your color, your ethnicity, your nationality, your sexual preference. This is what the modern Democratic has become," end quote, Faso continued. Quote, "That's why a guy like Paul Van Blarkum isn't nominated. This is not the party of JFK, of Harry Truman. It's not even the party of Hugh Carey or Daniel Patrick Moynihan. They've gone so far left, they don't even know what it means," end quote, Faso said. You can read the full story in the Mid-Hudson News Network.
Also this week on May 31st, the Poughkeepsie Journal editorial board released an interview they did with Faso. Here's an excerpt.
"Hi, I'm John Penny. I'm the opinion engagement editor at Poughkeepsie Journal. So, Congressman, we so much appreciate you coming.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You know, you're making the rounds around the district, I guess. And when are you heading back to D.C.?
We go back to D.C. next week. I believe it's Tuesday.
Oh, okay.
That we go back.
Great.
And this is the week after the Memorial Day week is typically a week when Congress will be on our district work period, as we call it.
Great. So what have you been doing?
Well, basically, I did four parades over the weekend and participated in a number of ceremonies in different places. We had a nice parade on Monday in Hyde Park with a ceremony at the American Legion afterwards. And then I went over to Kingston where the city and the veterans, the American Legion, had a wonderful ceremony with the pipe band, with the Kingston alumni high school chorus, which was terrific. And then we had a parade marching through Kingston down towards the ball field. So it was a very, very nice event, both of them. And when I got home later that day, my wife had some chores for me to do. So I got those
good
things. Because sometimes when you happen to go to Washington, you can't get those necessities around the house done as quickly as you might otherwise.
And speaking of chores, when you get back to Washington, there's a whole list of things that we could talk about. And hopefully we'll get to as many of them as we can. But let me just start with kind of an overview that we know how divisive the times are in so many respects, and we know, quite frankly, that your office has been, to some degree, under siege since from the beginning, at least from certain quarters. How have you been able to just accomplish things? You know, how do you keep going forward, and what would you say you have accomplished, you know, under some really trying circumstances?
Yeah, these are contentious times. They're polarized times, and I think that there are a lot of reasons for that. It didn't actually start with with Donald Trump and his election. I think we've become increasingly polarized in over the last decade, maybe decades. But I think one of the factors, and perhaps you would be better than me to analyze this, is I think the 24/7 media news cycle tends to have people go into their own camps. People look at media that they agree with. They watch the programs and the shows that they may agree with. And what sells in terms of radio programs, TV programs, in terms of advertising mm-hmm. and revenue is controversy. Mm-hmm. So I joke with constituents. I say, you may think in Washington the Democrats and Republicans are at each other's throats 100% of the time. It's really only about 50% of the time.
Right.
We actually have a fair number of things that we've done on a bipartisan basis. And whether it's passing a right to try legislation that in the House last week, which has already passed the Senate, the president's going to sign, that will let someone with a terminally ill condition try a experimental drug under certain circumstances. But this is a groundbreaking bill. It's been a lot of people have talked about this for a year. We passed it. We've passed a number of reforms at the VA. We've passed the Defense Authorization Bill just last week, and that bill was a bipartisan bill. I think there were only 60 votes against it. And so we have a number of initiatives on opioid addiction. I'm leading an effort called the STOP Act, which is to try to deal with the shipment of fentanyl from China through the U.S. mail into the United States. And I should also tell you, you're right, these are contentious times, and from the day I was elected, I have had people demonstrating and protesting and things like that, and I understand that that's their right, but what I've tried to do is to be a calming voice in this process and to be someone that listens to people who may not agree with me. I am ranked by the Lugar Center, which is a nonpartisan group in Washington, as the 18th most bipartisan member of the House of Representatives out of 435. So I think I've compiled a record that shows that I work with people across the aisle, but I still maintain my principles and I'm trying to get stuff done.
You have been criticized for not holding town halls, though, when you say that you talk to people and you work with people. That has been one of the criticisms. How do you handle that criticism?
Well, I think that that's really misplaced, that criticism. I had a televised town hall at the public television station. Anyone could sign up if they were from the district. That was done with the public TV station in the northern part of the district. And I did a public town hall, which was attended by hundreds of people last August in Ulster County. And I stood there for 2 hours and answered any question anyone has. But the thing is that I've literally had, I think the last time we counted, it was close to 900 meetings with constituents. Mm-hmm. In the district and down in Washington. They might be individuals who have a problem, or they might be a group of people that are coming in together. But the thing is that I think what's much more conducive to civil discourse is to sit with people across the table mm-hmm. and to discuss these issues and hear what they say. They can hear what my response is. And I make myself available. I always call the media back. I talk to the press constantly. I'm not one of these people that's insulated from the press. Though I know you're really tough, difficult people.
And, at times.
But the fact is that I am out there all the time, and that's part of my job.
Now, I want to go back, because you talked about the 24/7 coverage, and I agree that a lot of that coverage, sadly, I find, particularly with cable news, is all about the process and about more polls and process, not about policy. I mean, I think one of the things, I'll put a hand up and say that the legacy sites, what we call legacy sites, the newspaper sites that are now websites, sites, we tend to be more policy oriented. I think that we could show that in many forms of our coverage. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that have not been completed. And I do want to start with the Farm Bill, which looked like it seemed like it was going to pass the House, and then people on your side of the aisle, Republicans, decided, a group of them decided that they wanted something more, they wanted something different, they wanted to actually tie in immigration reform. So did that surprise you that came up? It seemed like the indication that this was at least going to get through the House, and then obviously it was going to be what was going to happen in the Senate was going to be a whole nother fight.
Yeah, I had a lot of trouble with what our colleagues in the Freedom Caucus did on the Farm Bill because they had an unrelated issue, namely immigration, and they wanted to have a vote on the Judiciary Chairman's bill, the so-called Goodlatte bill, mm-hmm. prior to a vote on the Farm Bill. Now, Speaker Ryan and Leader McCarthy had committed to them that they would have a date certain in June where they would get a vote on that bill. Mm-hmm. And yet they decided to take hostages and shoot the innocent mm-hmm. on an issue that wasn't related to the Farm Bill, which was really something that annoyed many of us who had worked a year and a half on that.
What do you say to people say, this is the problem when one party tries to control a bill and it wasn't a bipartisan bill? If you had a bipartisan bill, maybe it would have been a flare-up over something else, but you could have worked. You wouldn't have needed their votes.
Well, number one, the Farm Bill is going to come back, mm-hmm. and it will pass. Two, the bill is a bipartisan bill, with the big exception of SNAP, right. which the Democrats, mystifyingly to me, object to stronger work requirements for able-bodied people between 18 and 59 receiving SNAP benefits. And there are a lot of reasons why we're trying to get those work requirements to be more stringent. The second thing is that on the whole issue of SNAP work requirements, what we're doing is we are funding employment and training, apprenticeship, programs that will allow individuals to relieve their situation of dependency on the government, allow them to get in the workforce. And this is really an important point here, John. Throughout our country, there are 6.5 million jobs that are going begging. You can go all throughout our district, which is larger than the state of Connecticut geographically, mm-hmm. and you see signs out, help wanted. There are a lot of jobs out there, but what I hear from employers, they can't necessarily find people who have the skills and the qualifications and the job readiness to meet those employer requirements for that job. So we're trying to say, look, if you are able-bodied, and you're 18 to 59, and you're not showing any income to the authorities when you apply for SNAP, well, then we need to get you into a training program. Mm-hmm. We need to get you into a job placement program, etc. And this was the entire thing the Democrats objected to. But the vast majority of what's in the Farm Bill had been negotiated on a bipartisan basis.
Okay, let me just back up and throw a few numbers at you. One from the Food Bank of the Hudson Valley, that there are about 124,000 people without regular access to affordable, nutritious food in the six-county region in the Hudson Valley. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the last time the Farm Bill came up, there was about an $800 million cut to the $80 billion SNAP program, about 1%. And it was a hue and cry about that. I believe Congressman Maloney supported that, and he took some grief from his side. But now you're talking about a $20 billion cut to an $80 billion program.
No, your numbers are wrong.
Correct me.
Okay, so with the SNAP program is going to spend about $60 billion. Now, there are about 44 million people on the SNAP program. It is the most of the reduction in expenditures on SNAP given to us by CBO is based upon the expectation of a improving economy and more people no longer qualifying because they're making income. Mm-hmm. And so there is no cut to SNAP. Any reduction in spending, however, we are plowing into employment and training programs. So, frankly, we wanted to avoid that argument. We wanted to avoid the allegation that we were somehow reducing the SNAP program under the guise to.
I just want to make sure you're clear. You're saying it's the same amount of money, but not the same amount of money, but the money is being shifted in terms under SNAP.
Whatever savings we get because of an improving economy, mm-hmm. and that's a CBO projection. It's there's no net deficit reduction or no net savings in this program, because any savings we get are being plowed into the state-run employment and training programs. Mm-hmm. And so The numbers, I don't know where you got that $20 billion number.
Well, that, hold on. That was the number for one that President Trump had used, that he was looking for a $20 billion cut.
Well, that was perhaps in a budget submission, and that was probably a number over a 10-year period.
Okay, but we're not taking into account what the Senate is going to go for. So you could say this is what, so where realistically are you going to end up?
So, I mean, this is why we have legislation in two houses.
Right.
So the program that we have put forward in the House has stricter work rules, but it doesn't have any net savings to the program or taxpayers. Any savings that may incidentally occur only because a better economy means fewer people receive SNAP. Remember, before the meltdown in 2008, there were about 24 million, 27 million people receiving SNAP. It went all the way up to nearly 50 million people. It is now down to 44 million, and the CBO has told us they expect that number to come down further. But again, we're trying to get at the folks who are the able-bodied 18 to 59-year-olds who show no income, who are not working, and trying to get them into employment and training. We're not talking about elderly, children, disabled, anyone with a child six or under. We're not talking about them. We're talking about people who have, in essence, dropped out of the workforce.
I guess my point is, if it took, the last time this came up, it was so difficult to even get a small reduction, which really was more about lowering the size of the increase, basically.
Yeah.
This seems so dramatic that even if you get it through the House, again, if it's a one party bill, if you have Democrats dropping off the bill, you know, the whole argument is you're not really going to get it through the Senate. And when do these things get accomplished?
So
that's the whole issue.
My argument would be that taxpayers expect, if you're able-bodied and you're not working and you don't have a disability, that you should be in the workforce if you're collecting public benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think most taxpayers expect, and I think it's a reasonable expectation. And what the Senate, it's going to be more difficult to get our bill through the Senate. Let's face it, the Senate is probably going to pass a somewhat different bill, but that's what we go to conference committee about, and we will try to advocate for these changes, which I think actually most taxpayers, be they Democrat, Republican, or somewhere in between, would think are logical. Do you know that there are whole states, California and Illinois, for instance, have basically waived their entire state out of any work requirements? Mm-hmm. This is crazy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. And again, the average person out there who's working for a living, supporting themselves and their family, paying their taxes, thinks that if someone is receiving a benefit and they're able-bodied, they should be working.
So you're optimistic this will pass the House eventually, and
yes,
there will be a deal with the Senate?
Yeah.
Where would you, you've been around these processes for a very long time, where do you think this ends up shaking out?
Well, I think that it'll be a compromise. Mm-hmm. And I think it has to, eventually, I don't want to negotiate against myself here, but I think eventually it's a stricter work rules, not let some states basically use bureaucratic gamesmanship to get out of the work rules and mm-hmm. to avoid them. You look at the state of Illinois. The entire state of Illinois is waived out of the work rules, I think, except for one county. The same thing in California. It makes no sense. And so, again, I think that it'll be a compromise, and I do think something will pass, and it needs to. I mean, also, in the Farm Bill, I have a number of provisions. I have a provision that deals with invasive species and pests that I worked on with the Cary Center at Millbrook. I've got a piece that says that we're going to increase the enforcement so that the Agriculture Department can detect false organic products coming into the country, because there's a real problem with fraudulent products labeled as organic that are not. Mm-hmm. And we're stepping up that program over a five-year period. And I also got an amendment added on the floor, which will increase our ability to monitor the agricultural conservation programs that are really important for productivity, for land preservation, and water protection in the bill. And lastly, I put an amendment in the bill on the floor which will give the states more flexibility in how they administer their SNAP programs, which they don't currently don't have now. So there are a lot of good things in this bill. We have some fixes for the dairy farmers, which are important. I mean, it's a...
And you ticked off some of the things that are important to New York, and we could spend the whole time on the farm bill, but you know...
But you want to move on.